It's a great pleasure to be here and to remember Ellie. We remember him so fondly and so strongly. Indeed, this is what you heard today was the second Sir Ellie Lauterpacht memorial lecture. The first one was already given 2 weeks ago in Australia by me. And I spent some time talking about his Australian experience as legal advisor from 1975 to 1977. What I'm about to say represents something of the second half of that lecture, in which I reflect on the Lauterpacht tradition. Leslie has told us about the building, and I'll say a little bit more about it later on, but I'm going to talk about the tradition which the building represents. Precisely because Hirsch's contribution was so well known, I'm going to focus rather on Ellie. That's appropriate for today. But when we renamed the centre, rather than being called the Research Centre, the Lauterpacht Centre, after Ellie's retirement, I have to say Ellie had to be dragged out of the building. He didn't want to retire. There was a deliberate equivocation in the name. It was both Ellie and Hirsch. And I want to reflect a bit on that in the context of the discussion of the Lauterpacht tradition. One can do this first by listing the various things that Ellie started or continued and which form part of that tradition, at least in retrospect. First, there was judging and arbitrating. He was once appointed ad hoc judge in a case before the court. Rosin has told us about his very important statement of the duties of a judge ad hoc. It has to be said in characteristic Ellie fashion, he took the limits of the duties of a judge ad hoc to their limit in that separate opinion, which was in certain respects a dissent. Having laid down the limitations of the role, he proceeded not to exactly to exceed them, but certainly to push them to the limit. Outside the court, he acted as arbitrator and judge in a number of important cases. We've heard about his work for the World Bank Administrative Tribunal, and the very important case de Merode, the first significant decision of that tribunal, which still regulates the activities of administrative tribunals worldwide in the context of the doctrine of acquired rights. He was arbitrator in a number of investment arbitrations, and he chaired a panel under Chapter 20 of NAFTA. His most important arbitral appointment, however, was as president of the Eritrea-Ethiopia Boundary Commission. Its unanimous decision on delimitation and virtual demarcation, I think the first time there'd been a virtual demarcation of land territory, displayed a resolute independence of thought and action, despite major difficulties of implementation. I will remember when the commission handed down its first decision on the boundary, I was counsel in the case. The logistics went wrong. We were supposed to be presented with the boundary at the last moment, after Sir Ellie had told us the reasons for the boundary. But the PCA got it wrong and presented the boundary before the reasons. So counsel spent their time glued on the bits of the boundary that they were responsible for, wondering what on earth it all meant. It was only rather reluctantly that the PCA then took it down and allowed Ellie to speak. But it was counsel and advisor that he spent most of his time. And here I want to emphasise the sheer length of his career, as Chris Greenwood has already done. His first appearance was in 1951, when he was drafted in to prepare the memorial in the famous Notterbohm case, through his association with a solicitor in Cambridge. Solicitors in Cambridge obviously have more international court cases than one might think. He also assisted in the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company case, though he was not formally retained. And it was the experience in the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company case that led to his two major contributions to investment law. One was the invention of the umbrella clause. The other was the drafting of the first draft in association with an ABA committee of the ICSID Convention. Now, the origins of the umbrella clause can be traced to an advice he provided in 1953 to the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company in connection with the oil nationalisation dispute. he suggested that the agreement to be reached between the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company and the government of Iran be protected by a treaty between the United Kingdom and Iran. In fact, no such treaty was concluded, but he made similar proposals in 1956-7 to a group of oil companies engaged in promoting a trunk pipeline from Iraq to the eastern Mediterranean. His contribution flowed through his working relationship with Sir Hartley Shawcross, former British Attorney General and British prosecutor at Nuremberg. Shawcross was incidentally, according to Ellie, the best advocate he ever heard, either in international or domestic proceedings. He was now director of Shell Petroleum. An early variant of the umbrella clause was included in the Abbs-Shawcroft draft convention on foreign investment in 1959. It was also included in the very first BIT between Germany and Pakistan, concluded in the same year. He was involved in 16 further cases before the court on Leslie's count, a remarkable number given the paucity of cases in the 20 years after 1966. The first in which he actually addressed the court was the preliminary objections phase of Barcelona traction, where he began with a personal remark referring to his father's death a couple of years earlier. He said, and I don't do impressions unlike Roger, "May I first express my distinct and deep sense of privilege upon being permitted to address you. If in my own case this feeling is mingled with another of a different nature, I'm sure the court will understand why." The last time he spoke before the court was in the seizure and detention of certain documents and data, Timor-Leste against Australia, provisional measures in 2014. He was unsparing in his criticism of the Australian government's action, having previously been legal advisor to the Australian government. "I was counsel for Australia in that case and refrained from all comment on the case whatever, including that one." He concluded his remarks with the following words, the last words he spoke before the court. "I thank you very much for allowing me to speak, and I need hardly say that it is with the greatest displeasure that I leave you now." At the time, it seemed a touch histrionic, but it was effective, indeed memorable. It may have had a hidden meaning, since Ellie had derived such evident pleasure from his work before the court over 62 years, that he quitted the stage with reluctance. Secondly, he was a great editor, the greatest of his time. We've heard about the International Law Reports, his 145 volumes, his 5 volumes of his father's papers, of the memorial lectures and other spin-off publications under the Grocer's imprint. When I arrived in Cambridge in 1992, I rang Cambridge University Press to find out what their law publishing intentions were. I was told by the receptionist, "We don't do law." Ellie changed that. Shortly thereafter, he sold Grotius for an undisclosed sum, but I'm sure it was a well-negotiated deal, to Cambridge, and Cambridge has not looked back in terms of its international law publishing since. That transition was due not to me, but to Ellie. And it's one of the many things he did. Third, he was a teacher and mentor of distinction, inspiring devotion from many, including many in Australia who attended the first of the memorial lectures, including judges and presidents of the court, foreign office legal advisors and professors in many countries. Fourthly, and this is the subject of this panel, he was the creator of the Lauter Park Centre of International Law. Established as an entity in 1983, or at least as a letterhead, through private benefactions, including his own, it's characteristic of his modesty that he doesn't refer to his own benefaction, which was part of the construction of the original building, in 1986. He directed the centre until his compulsory retirement in September 1995, and I've already described that. During this whole period, the centre had no funding whatever from the university, a situation which changed to a degree because I refused to have anything to do with the centre unless the university provided some funding. The university thereafter has provided extremely modest funding to the university, to the centre, acknowledging the treasure it had been gifted. That was when the decision was taken to rename the centre the Latapuck Centre. He remained, however, actively involved as honorary director, looking over the shoulder, or possibly both shoulders, of successive directors, but always with a good sense of humour. He helped in attracting the funding from the Kingdom of Bahrain and the Government of Malaysia for the acquisition of the next-door house, 7 Cranmer Road, which doubled the size of the centre. The word unique is overused, but it's appropriate when it refers to the centre. University centres of international law are common, but the Latapuck Centre has a distinct persona, its own identity, while being fully part of the law faculty. It is above all a welcoming place, a place that people come to and find friendship, assistance and support. It's had more than 700 guest researchers in the period of its existence, an astonishing number. As a centre for study, research and publication in international law, and as a draw card for visiting scholars, it is unique in the English-speaking world. One thinks of the Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg as its opposite number in the continental world, but just think of the resources devoted to the Max Planck Institute in Heidelberg. I would think probably 1 month's resources of the Max Planck Institute constitute the university's expenditure on the centre for the whole period. But I may be exaggerating. In reviewing his career, it is worth stressing, first of all, how different he was from his father. Despite the filial piety evident from his editing of the collected papers and from his biography. Ellie was and sounded English, a tribute to the, I hope not disappearing, capacity of the United Kingdom to thoroughly anglicise in a single generation. Let's hope it remains that way, despite Brexit. Hirsch, by contrast, to judge from those who knew him, as I did not, was and remained Central European, polyglot and polymath. Hirsch was a European civil lawyer by formation, despite the later influence of McNair, and a strong sense of case law method, which I think he acquired while he was here. Ellie was a thoroughgoing common lawyer with no special European affinity. Hirsch is remembered above all for his monographs, and it's characteristic of his monographs that you remember them by single titles. Private Law Sources and Analogies, Development of International Law, not once but twice, once for the Permanent Court, once for the International Court. An International Bill of the Rights of Man, subsequently rewritten as International Law and Human Rights. Recognition, and above all, the Function of Law. The Function of Law was written at a moment of deep trauma in the international and European legal system. And yet it's a work of transcending positive message. A marvellous book, the best book of international law of the 20th century. Uniquely amongst international lawyers of his generation, or probably of any generation after Grotius, most of these books are still in print. 3 have been recently re-released with substantial introductions. Ellie was not an enthusiast for monographs. He never wrote one, nor did he take up the monograph series started by Hirsch in 1946, Cambridge Studies in International and Comparative Law. This is one of the few aspects of his father's heritage that he neglected. Despite his father's urgings, he didn't always do what his father wanted, even though what he did, his father ended up by appreciating. Despite his father's urgings, Ellie did not undertake doctoral studies, but Hirsch did so twice in the German tradition, supervised respectively by Hans Kelsen at Vienna and Arnold McNair at the LSE. The two theses contradicted each other, which shows you how quickly Hirsch acclimatized. Ellie was above all a practitioner, whereas Hirsch's career as practitioner was fairly brief and by Hirsch's standards unspectacular, leaving Nuremberg to one side. Of course, they had certain things in common, especially a devotion to international law and a sense of its importance. But they had as many differences as they had similarities. Hirsch was more interested in ideas than institutions. He wrote comparatively little about the institutional law of even the covenant or the charter, leaving it to Dame Rosalind Higgins to produce Oppenheim on institutions, which we're looking forward to seeing. Characteristic ideas of Hirsch revolve around a distrust, amounting at times to a devaluation of the state. Sovereignty is seen not as a value, but as a diminishing quantity, identified with the relative notion of domestic jurisdiction. International law is, and should be, seen as in a state of progress towards domestic, or at least federal law, and private law to boot. Hence the value of private law analogies. For Hirsch, the real subjects of international law were individual human beings, in whose disaggregated interests all law, international law included, exists and should exist. The real enemy of law was self-judgment, allied to which was non-justiciability. This is the leitmotif of the function of law, and from it flowed also his thesis of the invalidity of the automatic reservation to the optional clause. In short, a strong reaction against Hegel in the light of Hitler, though we can't find any use of the word Hitler in any of his voluminous writings. Little or nothing is to be found of this in Ely's work. He accepted the value of human rights, indeed he wrote usefully on refugees, but he placed limited emphasis on them in practice. His father thought recognition constitutive, not because individual state judgments of legal status should be definitive, but because someone had to perform the certification function and it couldn't be the putative state itself. The son, in his capacity as Australian legal advisor, suggested that recognition should be abolished because it made no legal difference. If an intellectual tradition associated with the Lauterpacht name survives, and it does, especially but not only at Cambridge, it is no doubt attributable to Hirsch rather than Ely. Ely was creative in his own way, but more as a builder of institutions than ideas, including the institution of his father, a datum of the biography. But international law is a continuing enterprise, a continuing struggle against certain basic facts of international life. It cannot rest on laurels, however distinguished their provenance. It needs institutions, places if not palaces. And it must be stressed of Ely that his creativity was not at all self-centred. For example, the Lauterpacht Centre was so named after his retirement, but against his inclination. He didn't want it named the Lauterpacht Centre, because he wanted to sell the naming rights. He frequently told me, why did you name it after Lauterpacht? The name doesn't matter, what matters is the substance of the money that is required to keep these institutions going. That was his view. My view was that the recollection of the Lauterpacht name was worth the cost, whatever the cost might have been. The naming, when it happened, was deliberately equivocal. Neither Ely nor Hirsch, therefore both. It seemed then, as it seemed now, absolutely appropriate. Thank you.